I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City Public Schools release last week of a dour system analysis came as a shock to many. The district has been riding a wave of positive reviews over the prospect of full accreditation. Now it will have to deal with the conclusions that it has an educational ecosystem that is complicated, expensive, and more segregated than it was 20 years ago. Today, two officials behind the report detail what the data reveals about Kansas City's public school system. Then folks in Kansas City have called Gloria Swatiro a lot of things, so why is this once First Lady and former Mayor Mark Funkhauser's top advisor reliving the turbulence in a series of memoirs? We'll find out as we get you up to date after this hour's news. The Kansas City School District just took a deep look at itself, and the results weren't all that pretty. The results showed that schools in Kansas City, both traditional public schools and charters, are more segregated and expensive to operate than they've been, and they're losing high school students. Just one example, 20 years ago, 32 of the district's 65 schools were segregated. By 2017, nearly 80% were. Another finding, charter schools aren't opening in the neighborhoods that need better schools. All that for a district that's been riding a wave of positive news coverage of late as it stands on the brink of regaining full accreditation. With us to talk about this new report, Linda Quinley is the chief financial officer for the district. Linda, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Mike Reynolds is the district's chief of research and assessment. Mike, nice to have you.
Thank you.
You know, Linda, there's a lot of takeaways here. You know, operating so many schools is costly. There's a lot of different grade configurations that make it tough for students to move through the system. I've mentioned segregated schools. Charter schools aren't opening in the neighborhoods that need the best schools. There's a lot to chew on here. What's your takeaway?
I think the primary takeaway for me as the finance person is that collectively we're responsible to the taxpayers of this community to provide a great education for every child wherever they land. And in order to do that, it was important for us to take this peek and understand where we were inefficient, because we want to drive resources into the classroom and in a system as wide as ours with as many buildings. Our cost on that non-instructional component, like busing and building utilities, is exorbitantly high.
And it sounds like you've got some work to do.
We do. We have a lot of work to do.
I'm wondering why this problem hasn't been addressed until this report came out.
You know, I think it's like everything. You have a lot of I think it must be while you're around things. And then under Dr. Bedell's leadership, Mike's department, who does the data, and me as new to the district, I'm ending my second year, we wanted to really get down and prove it. Because when you do the work to put the numbers on the page and you do the research, it helps have an actual conversation now. We could talk about we thought so, but now we know so.
Yeah. Mike, I'm curious about your takeaway from this extensive report.
Well, there is a lot here to chew on, Steve. You are correct.
Yeah.
I think the moral of the story is that Kansas City Public Schools, both the charter schools and the traditional district, are improving, but there is a lot more work to be done. And what we're really trying to do is have a hard look at ourselves as a system and reach a level of consensus to what we look like to really start a community conversation about the best path forward to really give this community what they deserve from the public education system.
Well, why was this report done and why was it done now?
Well, as Ms. Quinley did state, under Dr. Bedell's leadership, we are taking a hard look at ourselves and we are reaching across the aisle. Traditionally, there has been a level of non-cooperation between the charters and the public schools. We are trying to usher in a new era where we understand that a rising tide lifts all boats. We want to come to a level of consensus with the other side to really improve the community as a whole and all options for students.
You know, some of the numbers out of this report were really concerning, Linda. One, why does the district operate so many schools? The district runs 83. The comparably sized Springfield district runs 53.
And that is really about choice. And we're not saying that choice is a bad thing, but we're saying choice has implications and costs. So in Springfield, there's a more traditional model, like many of us probably experienced, where you go to elementary school and you know where you'll go to middle school and you'll know where you'll go to high school. And they are all built in what we refer to as a feeder pattern that makes sense size-wise. When you have choice, us with our signature schools and then the 23 charter LEAs that are in town, that choice starts with zero students a lot of times. It has to grow into the right numbers. But it is difficult with as much choice as we have inside the system, again, us plus charters, to make sure that a school is right size, that there are probably 500 to 700 children in a middle school and there's 1,000 kids in a high school. That's what most traditional districts try to accomplish in order to have efficiencies.
How many of these 83 schools in the Kansas City district are charters? Roughly half. Roughly half. And does Springfield have charters as well?
No.
I was going to say, there's a big difference there.
Yeah. In the state of Missouri, only St. Louis and Kansas City can have charters. And so Springfield is, we're comparing ourselves to the same number of students as Kansas City when you add us to the charters, but a different environment.
A lot of the cost from having so many schools comes down in the form of transportation. The district, according to the report, spends more than $80 million a year on transportation compared to the comparably sized district in Springfield. Again, that's a lot of money.
Actually, the number is $29 million in Kansas City.
More than Springfield.
And $29 million total for transportation and $11 million in Springfield.
Okay.
So more than twice as much. And when I like to share this to help people understand it, it goes back to that choice piece. If you think about, if you sat on your porch and had a coffee one morning during bus times, whereas in most neighborhoods in Springfield, you would see one bus come through to gather those children and take them to one school.
In Kansas City, you see four or five.
Exactly.
Yeah. And does that need to change in your estimation?
You know, it's one of the things that we're working on most soon, because what it does is there's $17 million that Springfield's able to put into the classroom that we're putting into busing in Kansas City when you add us to the charters. And what we want to do is work with charters and look at ourselves to make sure we're creating efficient routes. How can we share? How can we be better at managing the cost of transportation?
Okay. We talked on the show about segregation the other day, Mike, but in a sense, this report suggests we're back to where we were at the time of the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown decision in the early 50s. Or do you see it differently?
It's probably a little bit different. Clearly, the numbers indicate that segregation in our school system is reemerging. And this is a national trend. But I do believe that a lot of this can be attributed to choice in the Kansas City system. There's just so many different places that you can go to school and choose, but the numbers do not lie. Our schools are resegregating right in front of our faces and underneath our feet.
Why is that happening?
I don't really have a one silver bullet answer. Our community is still relatively segregated, and I think that we can agree on that. And I think that it's a very difficult task to unsegregate schools when you don't unsegregate a community.
But Lincoln Prep, traditionally and historically black school, may not be majority black in a few years. That strikes me as a big change pushing back against this trend, Mike.
Lincoln Prep is a school of choice. And what we are seeing demographically through census data, through American Community Survey data, and when you just drive around Kansas City, you do see a level of gentrification that is happening. There are demographic shifts that are happening in our community. And Kansas City Public Schools is, you know, our demographics are shifting with the community demographics. We do see a loss of African Americans in the Central Core. We see a rise of Hispanic population in the North and the Northeast area.
That's one of the big trends out there.
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah. I want to go back to the dollars and cents here, Linda. You mentioned, I want to get these numbers right. The Kansas City District spends $29 million a year on transportation. Springfield, comparably sized, spends $11 million. That difference, those millions of dollars of difference there, what are we losing having to spend so much on transportation? What's the cost?
The cost is in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So we spend more per pupil than Springfield does by a significant amount of money. And again, we is us plus the charter schools. And those numbers that you shared are us plus the charter schools. But what it means is we have less dollars to offer great electives for kids in the classroom, to offer great extracurricular and those kinds of things, offer professional development and competitive salaries for teachers, where Springfield, since they don't have to put as much money into those operational things, they have more money to put into the students.
So again, this would be a set of policy decisions the board might have to look at rather intensely in the months and years to come.
The board and the legislation and all of our charter partners collectively, because these are numbers that come from all of us, so we have to do it together.
I want to cite one part of the report here too, Mike. The number of, there's this term, intensely segregated schools has also increased. An intensely segregated district is one where more than 90% of students are poor and more than 90% of students are Black or Hispanic. Get this, in 1999, just 6 schools were regarded as intensely segregated. In 2017, 27 schools, 10 district, 17 charter, were intensely segregated. Again, that's a huge increase.
We do agree with you, Steve. That is a huge increase. The why is a very important question. It is critical that we understand context. In 99, we were coming off the desegregation suit, and we did see a significant loss of portions of our population. Generally agreed that the west side of Kansas City and a lot of the white population stopped attending Kansas City public schools. As we move forward into 2017, we're slowly getting some of that population back, but this is probably, it's tough to attribute cause, Steve. Mm-hmm. It really is. We just know that this is happening underneath our feet, and this is something that we do have to pay attention to.
But roughly, what's the current number of students, percentage, who are white in the district? 10%?
About 10, 11%.
Okay, and that number is going up, you're saying?
It is going up, sir.
Okay. Another issue the report cites, charter schools aren't opening in the neighborhoods that need better schools. This is a nationwide issue, not just in Kansas City. Linda, why is this? There have been some charters that have opened in some less well-off neighborhoods. I know that's also true, but why this trend?
Difficult for me to answer since I don't have that charter lens. I personally would guess they open where they believe they can do a couple of things. Find an appropriate facility to have a school in and where they think families will choose to come.
Does the district have any control over where charter schools open?
We have no control over any opening, closing of charter schools other than those we might sponsor.
Does the state oversee that?
There are various charter sponsors, the University of Missouri, UMKC, right. The Charter Commission, and one other college or university.
Central Missouri,
UCM. They are charter sponsors, as is the district. We sponsor a charter as well. So the sponsors are responsible to the state, but the sponsors oversee the charter schools.
So the sponsors pretty much pick the location, if I'm hearing you right?
I think that the school itself does as it's trying to open, but it has to get its sponsors' support.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a new report, a self-reflective report that the Kansas City, Missouri School District has just issued, outlining a whole host of challenges facing the district. Another concern, Mike, the district estimates schools have seats for about 33,000 students system-wide, but they aren't evenly distributed around the city. In fact, there aren't enough seats in the northeast and southeast attendance zones. How big a concern is that?
It is definitely a concern, Steve. We want seats where kids are located. And one of the things this does is this contributes to transportation inefficiencies. And we believe that the neighborhood school is a very important concept, too. It helps build community. It helps get you to know your neighbors, a level of familiarity with your neighborhood. This is a concern for us, and this is something that we're definitely addressing and looking at moving forward.
You mentioned that Black enrollment is declining. Why is that?
We believe that Black enrollment is declining because it is following the trend of immigration to first and second ring suburbs of our traditional African-American population in Kansas City public school boundaries.
And you also mentioned that there's a growing segment of Latinos moving into the district. That's resulted in an increase in the number of students with limited English proficiency. What kind of challenge does that pose?
Well, it does pose a challenge. And this isn't directly, you know, a lot of these kids are Latino, but I do want to emphasize that Northeast Kansas City has very robust immigration from around the entire world. Some of our schools have 30 to 35 languages spoken in them besides Spanish. But this does pose a challenge. You know, a lot of times these kids come without formal English. They walk into our schools, sometimes being in refugee camps for over a year with no formal education. So getting these kids up to speed with academic language, mathematics, cultural assimilation, these type of things are a significant challenge for us, and they do require resources.
Wyandotte County schools face much of the same issue, and this is one of the big distinctions between the challenges in an inner urban district versus suburban districts, right?
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah. Okay. In Kansas City, one thing, so many different grade configurations have made it tough to move through the system. In Kansas City, Linda, there are K through fourth grade schools, K through eighth grade schools, schools that stop in sixth grade, separate middle schools, and combined high schools. How tough is this for parents to navigate?
It's incredibly tough, and it's one of the things that caused us to want to do this study, because we believe we need to work collectively to make it easier for families. If your child's in a K-4 school and the next school they want to go to starts at sixth grade, what do they do for fifth grade? Do they have three transitions in 2 years' time, or two transitions in 3 years' time? So it's very difficult for families. It's also difficult for us to plan and expect students. Who's going to show up for middle school is a very tough challenge, because there are lots of options after fourth grade, fifth grade, and sixth grade in different makeups.
So am I hearing here that there's going to be pressure going forward on more uniformity within the district? You talk about all these different grade configurations, transportation issues, a number of choices available to parents. Do you think that's likely to change?
I think it's something we definitely want to talk with our charter counterparts about. And one of the reasons that a charter school might be a K-2 or a K-4 or a 6-7 and not a 6-8 is that they start with a couple of grades and get that student population in. And then as the third grader becomes a fourth grader, they add a fourth grade section. As the fourth graders become fifth, they add a fifth grade. So it's sort of a natural growth for charter schools. But with as many of those as we have a lot of them in that all over the board kind of range. So we hope maybe we can help modify the increase in number of schools and get to more traditional grade configurations across the board.
Another interesting point the report makes, Mike, is that families are leaving the district because they don't like the options when it comes to high schools. What's your analysis of that one?
That is quite possible, Steve. One thing that we do know is that families do exit our system when it's time to enter the secondary school. Seventh and ninth grade are traditional exit and entry grades.
There's a sense they can get quality and value in the elementary grades, but not the higher grades.
Well, there's a lot going on here. Yes, we do definitely witness a loss of students as they matriculate from elementary to secondary schools. One thing that I can point to that I do think is a root cause of this is the confusing system, the multiple entry points, the lack of continuity with entry and exit grades really does create a system where you never know where you're going next, where your student body from one school is split six different ways when they exit. There's no continuity, there's no uniformity, and it is a little bit of a confusing exercise for parents to figure out where they want to go for their secondary schools.
You know, one consequence of that is there are 6,000 students in 15 high schools. The superintendent often complains he can't provide students with a complete high school experience like academics and athletics and other activities because the cohort is so small. Again, a challenge going forward.
It really is. And it's what we're all of us, all of the LEAs in Kansas City are here for the students. So what we have to do is figure out how do we give them a quality secondary experience. And to do that, we need larger high schools. You'll typically, in a community our size, your high school ought to be 1,200 kids. And when you have a 1,200-kid high school, you can offer several foreign languages. You can offer fine arts at a high level, and you can have competitive sports for ninth graders, JV, and varsity. That's where we need to head.
And some high schools in Kansas City have how many students?
There are some as small as a couple of 100. Our average is 400.
Okay. What's the next step here? What happens now?
Conversations with the community. Consensus about what we really look like and a level of consensus where we want to move forward. You know, Kansas City Public Schools is committed to creating a more equitable system for everybody who lives within our physical boundaries. And we really want to provide what's best for this community. So the next step, Steve, is a conversation. The purpose of this report that we're doing is to really have a holistic look at ourselves, no makeup, what we really look like. Because Once we see the facts, then we have to decide where we move forward.
Well, I think you got that. This is a pretty plain-spoken report. This is Harry Truman talking to you guys.
And one of our goals is to really not assess blame, because there's a lot of blame to go around. Right. You know, we got this way over 30 years. It's not going to be fixed overnight. So we have to have an honest conversation about who we are and what we want to look like moving forward.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Linda Quinley, Chief Financial Officer for the Kansas City Public School District. Mike Reynolds, the district's Chief of Research and Assessment. Thanks for the update. Appreciate all the information.
You're welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much.
Time for a break. When we come back, Gloria Squitiero, the former First Lady of Kansas City, joins us to talk about her new memoir. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be live on the site of the Walking Wall at the Nelson Atkins Museum, hear from the artist behind the design to learn more about his vision and what the wall represents. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Gloria Squitiero knows all about weathering storms. During her 4 years as First Lady, she and her husband, former Mayor Mark Funkhauser, endured a recall effort, lawsuits, and more criticism than some folks receive in a lifetime. Her role as an activist First Lady became apparent more than a year into Funkhauser's term when citizens learned that it was Gloria Squitiero who was managing the office and even making key personnel decisions. Later, the city council voted to ban her from the mayor's office, but that didn't stop Funkhauser from relying on her as his top advisor. That caper made national headlines. It was one controversy after another, and Gloria Squitiero joins me now to talk about all that in the release of the first of a three-volume memoir. The title of the first one, May Cause Drowsiness and Blurred Vision, The Side Effects of Bravery. Gloria Squitiero joins me here in the studio, and welcome. So nice to see you.
Hey there. Good to see you.
This is a very personal memoir. It covers your family's summer-long European journey, your decision to set up a campaign office, and prepare for your husband's run for the city's highest office. In future volumes, you'll talk more about the campaign and time at City Hall. But why did you want to go back and revisit all this and all the controversy?
The controversy is in the third book. So mm-hmm. The first book is nothing to do with controversy. It basically just describes us, our family, who we are, me specifically, what type of a person I am, afraid, mm-hmm. but never willing to let fear keep me down. And then the part of me that is a family woman and, you know, dutifully helping her husband set up a headquarters because he worked for City Hall at the time and wasn't allowed to really run for office until he gave up that position mm-hmm. as city auditor.
But still, this was a pretty tumultuous time. I think everyone remembers. Why do you want to go back and talk about it again?
Well, I think that everybody deserves a voice, and I don't think
you didn't have your chance.
I don't think I had my voice. There was many voices talking for me when I lived in Kansas City, but my voice was not really heard. And I think there's an epidemic of loneliness in our country today. And I think that comes from people not getting to have their voice. I think people are anxious, and so they keep everything in. And that's why we're seeing kind of a lot of meanness in America today.
Why three volumes?
I had a lot to say.
You always have.
Is that right?
And here it comes. Sure you did. Yeah. Tell us about the subtitle of the book, The Side Effects of Bravery, because in these pages you write a whole lot about your own personal growth.
Yeah. So to me, you know, I grew up in a New York Italian family, and women, especially girls, didn't have a voice. Didn't matter. You weren't heard. And I had a lot of anxiety from that. And especially after a childhood girlfriend died at 20, I had a really long bout of anxiety until I found the right therapist to help me overcome mm-hmm. that. The cure is that I had to speak my thoughts and emotions. And I think, you know, it takes a lot of courage and bravery to step out of your comfort zone and live the destiny you want. And I wanted a bigger destiny than what I had.
Have you achieved it? because what comes through in this book is you don't hesitate to say much of anything, Gloria. What's on your mind typically comes out.
That you're looking at 20 years after I was cured mm-hmm. in therapy. And so I've always been an open book, actually. I've always said what I think. I try to be kind with saying what I think. But I think the book, yeah, it's totally open book.
What do you want readers to take away from this first volume?
The first volume is to not let logistics get in your way of reaching for your dreams.
Logistics like what?
So for me, personally, it was fear and money. You know, I always wanted to go to Europe, and I am a homebody, and so I knew I had to go for a long time, so I wanted to go for a summer and really live the culture, you know? And if you don't have money to spend a summer in Europe, you got to find other ways of doing that. So we found that, you know, Funk always wanted to write a book. So he won a grant to write a book, do research across Europe. And so we did that, and I got to go to Europe. But then how do I get there when I'm afraid to get on a plane? Hmm. Well, so I figured out how to do that.
You took a boat.
Took a boat. But then even leaving home for a homebody is hard and somebody that has anxiety. And so I basically designed a little ritual for myself in my backyard and prayed for strength and courage and to actually grow up on that trip. Mm. And I think I succeeded at that. You know, it wasn't climatic. When I got off the boat, I was a totally different person. But I was well on my way to being a much stronger, braver person than I was before I stepped on the boat.
Former Kansas City First Lady Gloria Squatiro is my guest. She has the first volume of a three-volume memoir has just been issued. That volume is titled May Cause Drowsiness and Blurred Vision, The Side Effects of Bravery, and she'll be appearing at a book signing at Barnes & Noble in Leawood on Saturday from 1 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't help but ask, why Leawood? Why not the plaza, the Barnes & Noble on the plaza?
The Barnes & Noble in Leawood is the one that wanted me.
There you go.
There you go.
Tell me a little bit more about fear and what you were fearful of, even as an adult into your marriage with a couple of kids. What was it that you were fighting, particularly in the early years of your marriage?
That's a good question. Well, certainly not my husband, mm-hmm. because my husband is the person who showed me the woman that I actually am.
He really brought you out, is what you write in here.
I never thought I had any strength about me. I didn't think I had any skills. Again, I was raised an Italian woman, and they're nothing. And I was always mad at Funk for not saving me. And really, that's his gift to me, is that he didn't. And he let me, one, know that I had an inner strength, and two, made me bring it out for myself, because he was not, he calls himself my knight in gray armor, not white armor.
You know, there are people who work with you at City Hall who are going to be shocked to hear what you're saying right now about this lack of inner strength, because to read what they say now, you never came across as somebody who lacked inner strength.
I know that, and that's so weird to me, and it's still hard for me to wrap my head around that, because I know who I am and what it takes for me to do come on this show, for mm-hmm. instance.
You're nervous being here.
I was a nervous wreck coming here, so it takes a lot of courage. And so the way I see myself, not so much as in the past, but I see myself as a pretty afraid person, almost afraid of everything. And yet others see me as being fearless. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I know that I'm passionate and I do speak and I speak what I think and I try to do it with kindness, but there's still a force behind that. And I think that force is maybe taken for fearless.
But I got the sense from reading the book that you would sort of set up a challenge for yourself going to Europe in this first volume, for instance, and you would decide in your mind, okay, I'm going to do this, and this is what I've got to do to get it done. And very methodically, you sort of pursued the goal and accomplished it.
I do. I'm a planner. I'm an executor. I'm a closer. And it all sounds really lovely, like coming to Kansas City. I've been so excited about this, coming back to see my friends, my neighborhood. I feel like it's my home. And yet the day before we leave, I'm like really calling Funk. Funk, I'm a nervous wreck. How am I going to get on that plane? Because I still don't do well on planes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I kind of fall apart, like when it's time to walk out the door. But before then, I'm like really excited.
And your husband still live in Washington.
Yes, we commute between D.C. and Long Beach, New York, which is just a little ocean town outside of Manhattan.
Well, let me ask you about some of your time at City Hall, because folks will be wanting to hear about that. I mean, were you the one who insisted on such a prominent role at City Hall, or was it your husband who wanted you there?
So that's interesting. So in the first book, I talk about setting up his headquarters just as a standpoint
of
a beautiful
wife. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, and so he had his press event. So this is going into the second book. So I was supposed to bow out of helping him once I got his office established and, you know, volunteer forms, you know, templates made. Basically, he was ready to go with this campaign all set up.
So what changed?
What changed is he had a press event and everybody left except for me and Dottie, which is his longtime secretary from the city auditor's office, and Funk. And we're sitting there and we're like, phew, that's done, thank God. And we're having lunch together and the phone started ringing. And we had six lines and they all started ringing and they never stopped ringing. And there was no volunteers yet to answer those phones. And so I sat down and I started answering the phone and that's how it went. And
but how did you go from that point, though, to going, he wins the election, and then taking a very prominent role as office manager, some described you as, up in the mayor's office?
I don't think I was his office manager. I became his
campaign. People regarded you that way, I think.
Yeah. I became his campaign manager by default. It turns out he cobbled together a pretty ragtag team of volunteers, and for some reason, we were able to create something really wow and made this guy who was kind of an unknown win an election. Mm-hmm. This the 30th largest city in the United States, I believe. And we did that. We won an election. And one of the ways that Funk thinks that we won that election is that I used to always send out a Christmas newsletter. And so now he wants me to write a campaign newsletter because his real campaign manager wrote the first campaign newsletter. Mm-hmm. And it was so not in Funk's voice. And so I rewrote that just because I wouldn't let something like that go out, and basically wrote the campaign newsletter as intimately as I did our family newsletters.
But a lot of people in this town concluded after a while that the arrangement with you up in City Hall didn't work. I mean, they thought this was such an awkward situation to have the mayor's wife up there on the 29th floor making occasionally, and maybe even more than that, important decisions. I mean, who could disagree with the mayor's wife? Was it awkward for the people who were up there?
So you started this conversation with, it seems like I'm really strong. Other people view me as strong.
Right.
I can tell you, nobody was afraid to tell the mayor's wife what they wanted the mayor's wife to know. Mm-hmm. That was not a problem.
But to disagree with you essentially as apparently meant that you were disagreeing with the mayor. And that's hard for employees to do who are working underneath the mayor.
But it wasn't. They did it.
But some of them said they struggled with that, though. It was awkward. A lot of tension.
Yeah. I don't think anybody in the main core of Funk's advisors felt that tension.
But some of them said that they did, though. I'm looking back. His former chief of staff, Ed Wolf, resigned at one point. He was, you know, a very well-respected guy. He complained having you up there was like having your mother-in-law go along on your honeymoon.
Yeah. I know that was said. To me, that That didn't happen.
But for him, he said it did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, all of this, you know, there was the big kerfluffle over whether you had made some racist comments. The city had to fork out more than $500,000 to pay for, you know, that settlement there. What do you want to say about that?
I'll say that that's not part of the first book, and that's been talked about so much. I'll say that that didn't happen. I'll say that the first book talks about the strong need of women needing a voice, really everybody needing a voice, and that I absolutely wanted to take that lawsuit to court to have my voice. The council settled that lawsuit against my will, and that is something that I absolutely didn't want to happen.
You know, also the city council tried to boot you out of City Hall. Relations between your husband and the council frayed to a dramatic point. And a lot of folks said you were the one responsible for that. As you look back on it now, any regrets?
I don't think that had anything to do with me. I think the controversy surrounding
the council said it had everything to do with you, Gloria.
They may have said that. That's not my reality. I think the reality is it had to do with power and money, and I got caught in the crosshairs.
And the fight was over who was going to run the city, the mayor or the council?
I don't know what the fight was about. That's Funk's field. You should ask him that question.
Do you have any regrets as you look back at your time at City Hall?
I really do. I think Funk saved the city financially, and I think that's wonderful. The crime rate was starting to go down, and I think that's wonderful. I regret that there was a woman during our campaign that very early on that I talked to, and a Black woman, her name was Imani. And, you know, she's, you know, I asked her, why are you here? Why are you supporting Funk? And because I asked every volunteer that, and she's like, basically, because I believe in him. I believe he's going to do what he said. And my thing is, why can't every neighborhood in Kansas City look like Brookside with window boxes and flowers spilling out? And that though, her words got to me. It's like, really, why can't every neighborhood look like Brookside in Kansas City? Like, and
there's a lot of reasons for that.
I regret. And again, that's Funk's field. But I regret that Funk wasn't able to finish what he started and make that happen.
That's Gloria Swatiro. Her new memoir, the first volume, is titled May Cause Drowsiness and Blurred Vision, The Side Effects of Bravery. Thanks for coming in and talking to us, Gloria. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Have you been around? Have you done your share of coming down? Different things that people do. Have you been aware? You got brothers and sisters who care about what's gonna happen to you in a year from now. Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Maybe I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away when we all live together.
Look who's here, Brian McTavish, to talk about some fun stuff to do on the weekend. And Burton Cummings, we're listening to him. He's actually going to be here himself in the flesh.
He is.
This weekend.
Yes, Steve, are you ready to give it all away so we can live together?
Yes, why not?
Once upon a time, that was the fervent hope of the young generation, right?
Yes. And the Guess Who.
Well, yes.
He was Burton a lead singer
Cummings,
for.
The yeah. voice of the Guess Who, the classic rocker who is Canadian. He's a big deal in Canada. He's a bigger deal here in North America, but especially Canada. And 8 o'clock Sunday night at Knuckleheads, Burton Cummings will make it happen. The sweet late 1960s and early 70s. Do you remember hits like...
I do.
This
remember
one?
Them all.
This
yes,
one?
Yes, I do, of
now,
course.
When you go out to Knuckleheads Sunday night, and there are still general admission tickets left, patchouli oil is optional, but not your love of the old-time music. This song...
Undone.
What's undone?
She came undone.
I see.
I love that song.
American Woman,
American
No Time.
Woman, No Time.
Laughing, Star Baby, These Eyes, and maybe my guilty
Fun
pleasure.
Stuff.
My guilty pleasure, Clap for the Wolfman, a novelty hit.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Honoring the famous
that's
radio
right.
DJ
Didn't
and
like
host
that song.
Of Wolfman Jack. Maybe
heard it a million times. Didn't like it.
I heard it a million times and liked it better every time because it was kind of like the Wolfman was a proto-rapper in a way on
that's
that
right.
disc.
That's true.
Anyway, do yourself a favor. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame in Canada, and he's in your personal Hall of Fame if you like this sort of thing, and I do, Sunday at Knuckleheads.
Gonna go out and play some golf, yeah, yeah. I'm gonna go out and play some golf. My golf bag's full of the latest stuff. I'm gonna go out and play some golf. My putter alone was a thousand.
Let's play some golf. We're gonna play it downtown,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Have you
downtown?
Done this?
Downtown? No. But
well,
I've...
first of all, are you a golfer?
No, I'm not, but you hit golf balls off buildings in downtown. That's
well,
what this is?
Hopefully not off the building. Now, they have a special golf ball for the downtown open, which is urban
better
golf.
Better be a softball.
Well, they have a special fancy name. I would call it a softy golf ball.
Let's
but it,
hope so.
It sort of decompresses when it hits a...
Yeah, when it hits a noggin.
Yeah,
yeah, there you
right,
go.
Exactly.
Or goes through a window.
So you can chip off Kansas City landmarks and putt at bars and corners downtown. You don't need to bring clubs. Please don't bring clubs. Just dress up in your favorite golf outfit. It's from 1 to 6 Saturday. The after party gets going in Washington Square Park at 5 o'clock. But if you don't want to watch, you can just show up and watch people.
Do you golf?
You know, I went to
you
a driving
golf.
Range once and I had trouble. I mean, what's the first trouble you
I
have?
I used to let go of the club and it would be like a giant boomerang causing death and mayhem, so I quit doing it.
They didn't let you back.
No,
after
they,
that
after
no,
that I tried.
I couldn't like, hit the ball. I couldn't hit the ball. It would go. It would just dribble.
It would just dribble.
It would just dribble. Yeah.
So you're no Tiger
Woods. Unlike
here,
where it's just a rushing onslaught of full tidal wave energy, right?
Okay. So that's this
yeah,
weekend.
Yeah, it's
okay.
That weekend. I could keep talking, but we got to go on.
Ride bikes.
Well, it's not a race so much as a tour. It's a bicycle tour of Kansas City breweries. It's back. It's the Tour de Beer, B-I-E-R. You like that? Tour de
yes.
Beer, KC. Now, if you want to participate in this thing, what you do is you get up bright and early, if you haven't already made arrangements, show up at 7 in the morning. It's walk-up registration. It begins at Knucklehead Saloon. That's when is that? Sunday? What does it say on your sheet?
I'm looking.
I'm gonna
7
say
a.m.
Sunday.
Sunday.
I'm going to say
yeah.
Sunday. Okay, and they got four routes, actually, and one does not even require a bike. There's a 15-mile route, there's a 30-mile route, and I know this is for you, a 50-mile route, but
wow.
more my speed. You get there bright and early, you get on the Barley bus, and it takes you to nine breweries.
And you
folks.
Don't ride any bike. Yeah.
No, only the bike in your head. And hey, the imagination is real.
That's early to be drinking beers.
No, a lot of people here to help you. Well, I'm not so sure you want to be drinking, maybe ringing the bell on your bike, but maybe what you do is it starts at Knuckleheads and it winds up at Knuckleheads. So if you're a biker or a bus rider, I guess if you're a bus rider, you can get bend the elbow anytime you want. But at the end, if you're biking, at the end, that's where you can have your beer or two. And there's a lot of paint on the roads to mark the route. Here's the thing, the routes, I should say. The potholes, look out. If you're on a bike, you think it's bad in the car.
Makes you nervous.
Do not hit
I'm a rider. Makes me nervous.
Do not hit.
Got to watch out for
don't
them.
Don't do it. That's right. And so here we go. Cinderblock Brewery, Big Rip Brewing Company, Strange Days Brewing Company, and so many more.
Okay.
Your love is like a Saturday. No work.
What do we have here?
Well, there might be some cotton candy. You know, I'm more of a funnel cake guy, but I'm opening up to
definitely
cotton candy.
Definitely funnel cakes
right?
over
and
cotton candy.
I think you should be able to find one or both at the Turkey Creek Festival. It's the 34th, my goodness,
34th
annual.
34th annual.
Wow. We're old enough to have gone to all of them and then some, right?
That's right.
34th, I can't even say it, annual family funorama. From Pony Rides to the Romies. And
out at Antioch Park,
yeah,
right?
We're listening to the Romies. 10 to 4 Saturday at Antioch Park in Overland Park. And you'll hear this tune. This is the headliner if you're into the music. From 2 to 4, they wind things up on Saturday at Turkey Creek Festival. Will you be there?
No, but I'll be at the next event.
Oh.
And finally today.
Oh.
one played it like Hootie.
No.
No one played it like Hootie.
Jay McShann, Hootie.
Still miss him.
The late Jay
McShann.
Still
miss seeing him. Think about him sometimes.
Yeah, nobody said this was a swinging town quite like Jay McShann.
Oh,
so,
man.
It's a view into Hootie's Blues. It's a listening party from 5:30 to 7.
It's a new album coming out.
Yes, Monday night. It's a listening party for the... It just released a month or two ago. It's called Jay McShann Live in Tokyo. Mm. Plus, you'll get McShann audio interview clips, and there'll be a Q&A afterwards with longtime KC DJ Groovy Grant and Blue Room General Manager Gerald Dunn.
Oh, Gerald, I have a rule. Whenever I see a used Hootie album anywhere, I buy it.
Why not?
Because he's the guy.
Why not? So you're showing
he's just
up.
The guy.
You're showing up 5:30 sharp at the Blue Room at 18th and Vine to take a special view of Hootie and his blues.
Not a way. A really good way to spend some time. We miss him.
I miss him.
Thank you very much. That's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Yesterday in the show, hear from Kansas City singer-songwriter Kelly Hunt. She performed Saturday night at the Folly. We heard tracks from her Beautiful Bones album. You can find it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Kansas City City Council has voted to bring all trash collection services in-house. We'll find out how that will impact residents and our city's budget. The show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.